Welcome to the Monitor Daily Podcast. It's Thursday, July 8th. Thanks for joining us. I'm Mark Sappenfield.
And I'm Jessica Mendoza.
Haiti and Afghanistan. If you wanted to pick two places on Earth that convey chronic hopelessness and dysfunction, you'd be hard-pressed to find better examples. Yet here we are with articles about them in today's issue. Most often, these countries are ignored, cast in terminal woe, or looked at through the distant lens of geopolitics. In short, they easily recede from our attention. That's understandable. For most of us, their stories will not affect our morning commute. By most definitions of relevance, they are not high on our list. But the Monitor has a different view. Our common humanity is relevant. Progress for every corner of the world is relevant. The values we share and hope to uphold are relevant, not just for historians or foreign policy buffs, for everyone. Our global story teaches us, deepens us, enriches us. What does the manner of the United States' departure from Afghanistan say about its sense of responsibility? We examine three key perspectives. And must we view the assassination of Haiti's president as another chapter in a story of unrelenting despair? There are seeds of hope buried deep, says writer Kathy Klarich. Can they flourish? That is relevant to all of us. When I heard about the assassination, I had a list of people I wanted to call to see how they were doing, but I didn't, because I knew they'd be busy figuring out next steps about how to make their country better, Kathy tells me. Everyone in their own way is trying to figure this out, she says, and because they haven't lost hope, I haven't lost hope. Now, today's stories. Our first story. Was the United States' abrupt final departure from Afghanistan a strategic necessity or a slap in the face? We consider how it looks to the U.S. military, to Afghans, and to the global community.
Before dawn last Friday, under cover of darkness, the last American troops at the vast Bagram Air Base in Afghanistan slipped away. They did not inform the new Afghan base commander, and before he could take control, looters had ransacked the former epicenter of the U.S. war against the Taliban. The Americans had clearly wanted to pull out in secret for reasons of security, but the slapdash withdrawal has attracted considerable attention for the message it conveyed, not least from Afghans themselves. Some feel betrayed. More broadly, other observers say the way the Americans snuck out raises questions about U.S. values and priorities. President Biden has made much of his intention to restore America to its place as a responsible global leader and moral standard bearer. But one former top Afghan government official, Timur Sharan, was not impressed. It sounds very much like cut and run to me at this stage and not taking responsibility, he says. This story was reported by Howard LaFranchi, Scott Peterson, and Anna Mulrine Groba in Washington, London, and Brussels for The Monitor.
This last Supreme Court term didn't take shape as many expected. But the key to understanding how the court might evolve could lie in its most conservative member, Justice Clarence Thomas.
For decades, United States Supreme Court Justice Clarence Thomas occupied a somewhat lonely place on the court's conservative fringe. He was prolific in his opinions, but often on his own, blazing an idiosyncratic path. In the term that ended last week, however, he appears to have become an increasingly pivotal figure. The court's new 6-3 conservative supermajority in many ways defied expectations. Some major decisions hit a clear conservative note, for example, reining in the Voting Rights Act. Others emphatically defied partisan lines. Yet clues left during this term and the cases on the docket for next term suggest a rightward turn could be coming. And Justice Thomas' intellectual fingerprints on the new court are showing. Arguments he's long made against abortion and affirmative action appear to be gaining traction. And most conspicuously, he's not alone so much anymore. Several justices are closer to Thomas ideologically than other conservatives on the court, says Ilya Shapiro of the Cato Institute. He has more allies. This story was reported by Henry Gass for The Monitor.
The assassination of Haiti's president adds to a growing climate of fear. Our former Haiti correspondent sees building civic and interpersonal trust as the only antidote.
A 5-year-old kidnapped and killed because her mother, a peanut vendor, couldn't pay the ransom. A journalist and a human rights activist shot dead in their car. Thousands of poor and working-class Haitians displaced because of gang warfare. Escalating instances of such unprecedented chaos as these in Haiti culminated this week in the assassination of President Jovenel Moïse. The event turned the spotlight on this Caribbean nation that, for all intents and purposes, had been switched off for more than a decade following the January 2010 earthquake that killed hundreds of thousands of people. Why should we care? Because in this global environment, there is a ripple effect. The pandemic taught us that, if nothing else. The violence and repeated failure of civil society to gain a stable foothold in Haiti is a symptom of a lack of trust. Trust across color and class lines, across international borders, and between weak, dysfunctional legislative, executive, and judicial institutions. Most of all, it is a lack of faith between individuals who take the grab-and-go mentality to the extreme. Haiti needs support from within and without to build a solid infrastructure. But more importantly, it needs the one-on-one trust that is the foundation of civil society. This story was reported by Kathy Klarich in Miami for The Monitor.
Last year's surge in protests against racism and police brutality drew harsh criticism in some quarters for being extremely violent or destructive. Fresh data analysis helps put those perceptions in a new light.
Over the past year, anti-racism protests have swept the United States. They were sparked by the death of George Floyd at the hands of now-convicted former Minneapolis police officer Derek Chauvin. Marches and protests spanned every U.S. state, a massive expression of public concern, but also a movement perceived by some to be violent. In January, Representative Paul Gosar of Arizona said Black Lives Matter burns and loots, for example. And in a Morning Consult poll 13 months ago, 42% of Americans said most protesters are trying to incite violence or destroy property. A zoomed-in view on a particular protest may show violence, but data from the Crowd Counting Consortium, or CCC, provides a zoomed-out view, showing that protests in the aggregate were largely peaceful. Started in 2017, the CCC is a public access database that tracks protest activity in the United States. With the help of a web crawler and citizen reporting, a research team compiles and codes protests reported in the media. The CCC breaks down violence into 4 categories: number of arrests, number of participant injuries, number of police injuries, and property damage. The group also tracks published estimates of crowd size. In CCC data collected from May 2020 to June 2021, 94% of protests involved no participant arrests, 97.9% involved no participant injuries, 98.6% involved no injuries to police, and 96.7% involved no property damage. Erica Chenoweth is a professor at the Harvard Kennedy School and co-director of the CCC. She says, worldwide, we're living in a time where we've seen more revolutionary movements using protest and nonviolent action more generally as their primary method than we've seen at any other time in the past 120 years. Inaccurately labeling a protest group as violent can be a political tool to delegitimize a movement's claims. A protest movement deemed violent by the media or political officials can lose momentum, depressing public interest and support. says Dr. Chenoweth. She says far more people are willing to participate in a movement that they perceive to be nonviolent. Because of the political salience of these terms, we have to be really careful when we're using them. This story was reported by Tara Adhikari for The Monitor. You can see data visualizations by Jake Turcotte in today's issue.
In our weekly progress roundup, new applications of technology are both protecting and uplifting vulnerable populations, including children who've been abused and refugees who've lost their homelands. You can find the full roundup of this week's Points of Progress by Lindsay McGinnis in today's issue. Now, commentary from the Monitor's editorial board on Afghan women embracing their rights as the Taliban advance. In the 3 months since President Joe Biden announced a U.S. troop withdrawal from Afghanistan, most American forces have left. And as the Taliban advances, many government soldiers have also quit. Yet amid this retreat, a new set of fighters has emerged. Hundreds of women have taken up arms, or at least brandished them, to prevent a return of the Taliban. Other women, less prone to violence, have taken another tactic. Many are making efforts for a ceasefire. Still others are providing moral support to retain civic rights that they have gained since a U.S.-led invasion ousted the Taliban 2 decades ago. For many Afghan women, civic rights now have what legal scholars call positive vitality. Or, as President Ashraf Ghani puts it, "I assure you, the women will no longer give up their rights here." A country with some 27 million smartphones is unlikely to go back to the dark ages of Taliban rule in the 1990s. The group will be forced to adjust, or, as many Afghan women now contend with arms or activism, it cannot take power. Civic rights are too firmly planted for Taliban guns to keep them from blossoming. That is a wrap for the news. You can find the full-length versions of these stories in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. Thank you for joining us today. Please come back tomorrow when Linda Feldman looks at why border politics are coming back to the fore. Today's Christian Science Spiritual Perspective contributor shares how every day offers the opportunity to commune with God in prayer that opens our eyes to Christ's powerful, healing presence. You can find the column in today's issue or at csmonitor.com/daily. We want to give a quick thanks to our staff, including today's audio production team, Uri Okike and Jeff Turton.
This podcast is produced by the Christian Science Monitor. Copyright 2021.